It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. About 10 years ago, podcasts splashed onto the media scene and became the big new thing. Producers were scrambling to make the next big podcast. Entire podcasting companies were created to cash in on the success. Everybody, it seemed like, wanted a piece of the podcasting pie, but the big money and ad deals didn't always live up to expectations. This year saw rounds of layoffs at major companies like Spotify and flagship shows canceled at public radio stations like NPR and WNYC. Our next guest follows the podcast industry. She's here to talk to us about podcasting's first boom and bust cycle, at least in many parts of the industry. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your take on podcasts? Have you been listening for years now? Are you just discovering some? Do you have a favorite? Is that favorite one still being created? Where do you go to listen to podcasts? What platform? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ariel Shapiro is the lead reporter of The Verge's audio industry newsletter, Hot Pod. She's a UW-Madison graduate, by the way. Ariel, thanks a lot for joining us today. Do we have Ariel? Are you there? Looks like I don't have audio on Ariel. Again, you could join in at 800-642-1234 to tell us about your podcast listening habits, if any. Join in at 800-642-1234. Ariel, I think we've got you. Hi.
Hey, Rob. So happy to be here. And sorry for the technical difficulties.
Well, that's live radio. Podcast can just edit that stuff out, but we're stuck with it here. But that's okay. I like it. Ariel, we've seen a lot happen in podcasts this year. Can you give us an overview, especially when we're talking about these produced podcasts, limited run specials, things like that? How big a shakeup has there been?
Yeah. So the kind of podcast that people think of as being these sort of anchor podcasts, right? Like in-depth narrative limited series, those are really having trouble right now. And part of that is because, and I think you alluded to this in your intro, there was a lot of investment in this space in the past several years, particularly by Spotify. Spotify bought Gimlet, which was one of the biggest independent podcast studios in the industry making these kind of series. And over the past year, they laid off almost the entirety of Gimlet staff. Mm-hmm. And this isn't the only place where we've seen this happening, right? There have been layoffs at NPR, at PRX, at Pushkin Industries, which is the podcast studio that is co-owned by Malcolm Gladwell. And part of the reason is there's sort of this idea, if you build it, they will come, right? Like there's definitely an appetite for these kind of podcasts. We saw that with Serial when it really exploded mm-hmm. on the scene. The problem is, has that advertising money come in, and is it enough to sustain the kind of production necessary for these shows? So not all podcasts are affected, right? Like always on chat podcasts, think of the Dax Shepherds, think of the Joe Rogans and the people who emulate Joe Rogan. Those are pretty cheap to make and they're easy to produce, whereas these more in-depth podcasts require a lot more work, a lot more reporting. It requires people, engineers. And at the end of the day, a lot of these companies saw that the math just wasn't working out, which is really unfortunate if you're a podcast lover, right? Like you want to see these kind of shows being made. And we don't want to see a world where the podcast landscape is, just celebrity chat shows.
It seems like podcasts are facing the same challenge as a lot of old media, a lot of new media, in that there's unlimited amounts of content out there. A lot of it is free for users. How do we get people to pay either in subscription, or how do we tap into a pool of finite advertising money? It turns out there's nothing special about podcasts compared to other media sources when it came to revenue.
Yeah, exactly. And you've seen some subscription efforts take off. It's been really successful at a place like Defector, which is really an interesting case. They had Normal Gossip, which if you haven't listened to it, is an absolutely fantastic podcast and was a really original premise, right? It was this show, very well made and actually very well researched, but just about everyday sort of ridiculous stories. And they've managed to build up not only an advertising business, but also a subscription business. But it's really an outlier. And it took off kind of the traditional way, right? Like word of mouth, people recommending the show to their friends. And it went viral from there. The problem is that discovery for podcasts is really difficult. And part of that is that it's audio, right? So the way that a lot of things will go viral on social media, it'll be through images and videos. You know, a lot of people now watch these videos with the sound off and the captions on. And some podcasts have managed to take advantage of this, video podcasts like Call Her Daddy with Alex Cooper, which is, you know, currently being produced by Spotify. But not everyone has the money to do that. And, you know, if we're getting into the video space, like really what's the difference between a video podcast and a YouTube video? So, you know, it's been really challenging for a lot of these, even very established podcast outlets to find a way to market their shows and find enough audience to really get that advertising revenue in.
Talking to Ariel Shapiro from The Verge, looking at the rise of podcasts, a big shakeup in the industry this year, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are now or ever have been a regular listener to a podcast or many podcasts, join in with your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jason is with us in Rapid River, Michigan. Jason, hi.
Hi. Your screener, she convinced me to stay on the line here. The reason I'm calling, I'm up in Rapid because I'm up at my camp here. It's very cold right now, but what I experienced the last couple of days is I don't want to listen to any of my inventory. And so your screener mentioned that listener burnout might be part of the conversation here. So, you know, I'm a big fan of the Bulwark podcast, the whole spectrum that they have. You might be familiar with Charlie Sykes.
Oh, I've talked to him a time or two.
That whole Bulwark lineup is great. And, you know, I used to listen to a lot of Joe Rogan and the Meat Eater, but I don't even know. I have no taste for it, and it's really weird what happened the last couple of days, and I think I'm experiencing the burnout.
Interesting, Jason. Thanks a lot. Is that a concern in podcast industry, Ariel, where, hey, it was this novelty, is this cool new thing for a while, and now, eh?
I mean, yes and no, right? Like I even find myself, right, like kind of burning out through my podcasts, or I'll cycle through them. Like I'll listen to them really regularly for a while and then kind of fall off, maybe come back to it later. I don't think people are burning out on it as a medium. I think that people tend to find other podcasts that pique their interests and that they can really get interested in. But again, for these individual producers and individual shows, yeah, maintaining an audience can be difficult, especially when there's so much out there. And you know, you also sometimes have these chat podcasts that can be 2 hours long, 3 hours long. You know, at a certain point, you've heard enough. So it's really about kind of, I do think people in the industry are thinking more closely about structure and about ways they can create podcasts that keep people on, not just through force of personality, right? Like not just because you're listening to someone that you really like, that, you know, maybe think Joe Rogan's funny. Maybe you think Theo Von is another one who's really coming up the ranks that people love. That it's not just that, that there are ways to have podcasts that are always on, but maybe you're getting a little bit more innovative with structure or the way that they produce.
Jason, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Ariel, I want to talk about the bewildering amount of ways that people listen to podcasts, maybe even define them. I've had people say they like my podcast. I don't have a podcast. I have this show, but they're listening to the archive version online later in the day. I guess that's a podcast for them. Spotify might produce a show, the Joe Rogan Show. You could only hear it on Spotify. Somebody else might produce a podcast. You can listen on their website at Apple and YouTube. I can't keep track. Is that creating confusion in the industry? Is that causing some of the problems?
So, I mean, yeah, this is something that we actually talk about all the time at The Verge and also at some of these podcast industry events that I've been to. You know, what is a podcast? And right now, that's not something that's so simple because yes, a lot of podcasts that people consume were originally radio shows. And that's actually something that you're seeing a lot of these public media outlets do, is focus on shows that can be on the radio first and then become a podcast. Then you have, you know, podcast first, but then you have YouTube shows that are functionally podcasts, but like, again, what are, you know, what exactly are they? And then muddying the waters even more are audiobooks. So now you see Spotify bringing audiobooks onto the platform, and increasingly they are, you know, traditionally think of an audiobook as maybe it's Pride and Prejudice, right? And it's one narrator who's doing the entire book. Now, because of podcasts, these audiobook producers are being pressured to create audiobooks that sound more like podcasts. You know, maybe they're shorter, they have multiple voices working in there, they have archival sound. And again, where do you really draw that line? So yeah, I mean, I guess if you can listen to it on the internet, it's a podcast, it's kind of complicated. And everyone's still trying to figure out where to draw that line. And that's particularly, it's particularly an issue when it does come to audiobooks, because they're used to charging a lot of money for audiobooks, right? If you have an Audible subscription, that's $15 a month for one audiobook. No one's paying $15 a month for one podcast a month. So, you know, again, the market is still figuring itself out.
Ariel Shapiro is with us, lead reporter of Hot Pod, an audio industry newsletter from The Verge. She's with us today to talk about podcasting's boom and bust cycle, including shakeups in the industry this year that could change what kind of podcasts get made, how they are made and distributed, what you end up listening to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to podcasts? Have these big changes to the industry affected your listening experience? What kind of podcast would you like to see get more funding and support? Do you like ones produced by various public radio outlets, private outlets, you name it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with reporter Ariel Shapiro from The Verge about layoffs, show cancellations in the podcast industry, what it could mean for the future of podcasting and your listening experience. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you checked out podcasts over the years? Are the ones you've gotten hooked on? Do you like investigative reporting, long-form interviews, true crime, business advice, former sitcom ensemble players who maybe stoned and talk about conspiracy theories? Whatever you like, let us know about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Lauren is with us in Wauwatosa. Lauren, hi.
Hi, avid podcaster here. So glad to be on. I'm glad you guys are talking about this. I have a comment and a question for thought. I'm that friend who is always like, oh, I was listening to a podcast and heard this, right? And I will say that once the big media companies seem to come in and start kind of formally and professionally producing podcasts, it seems like it took away from the original mystique, was this kind of like independent landscape where people were exploring with production quality and doing investigations independently. And obviously there needs to be revenue, you know, driving some of that. But I think it's driven some fatigue. We hear the same advertisers over and over, so there loses this authenticity. You kind of used to feel connected to your podcast host that they were recommending a product, right? So that was something you tolerated. So that's just something I've personally noticed. And it's driven me more towards audiobooks. So like that long form, high quality investigation, I'm turning more to books, which is an interesting reflection.
Interesting experience, Lauren. Thanks so much for sharing that. Ariel, this, I'm guessing Lauren's not the only one who's thought this, that, hey, they were kind of cool to start, then big business got into it and they all kind of blanded out a little bit. Is this something you've heard from other people?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, and I want to be a little bit fair to the big business here, in that when Spotify got into it, you know, they were making some really interesting, incredible shows, right? Like How to Save a Planet was the best podcast on the market about climate change. And it was getting at it in really thoughtful and important ways. But when push came to shove and it wasn't making a profit, you know, it was gone. And that's sort of the problem, right? Is that you had all this money come in, bring in really smart people, creative producers who wanted to make great stuff. I mean, it's the same thing you saw in video streaming, right? Where you had all this incredible content that wasn't possible before. Then, right, then reality hits and it's not just about growth and it's about margin. And when you have a for-profit company that where it's really about their bottom line, like that's going to take precedence over everything. And so, yeah, now you're seeing the effect of that, of what are the most profitable shows. And again, this goes back to the celebrity chat shows, and it does become sort of monotonous. They're certainly not the kind of shows that I like to listen to. It doesn't mean that they don't value. Mm-hmm. I will even defend Joe Rogan in that he is certainly an interesting interviewer, and there's a reason why people listen to him, right? But yeah, it makes perfect sense that Lauren would turn to audiobooks, because on the flip side, you're going to see that kind of in-depth exploration that she's looking for. And also, there's been so much innovation in terms of audio production that they've been able to ingest that has come out of the podcast movement. So, you know, it's not all bad, right? like thing, you know, things change and they shift. And I do believe that, you know, the industry will mature and figure itself out and find a way to support these shows, because there are so many people who want to make them. But, you know, it's a difficult time right now. So, and obviously that has an effect on consumers.
Thanks for that call, Lauren. Jenny is with us now in Lake Geneva. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, so for a living, I'm a mobile dog groomer. So most of my day is spent with ear protection on. I listen to so many podcasts every day. Actually, I listen to this show via podcast, but for some random reason today, I ran out of my Monday podcast and
yay,
thought I'd come. And there are also really good Wisconsin podcasts out there. For example, I live in Lake Geneva, and we have, I forget her name, but a woman who does a really great local show and interviews local businesses. And I absolutely have learned so much from that one. I love, like, Charlie Behrens has mm-hmm. a podcast. He's in Wisconsin, and lots of comedies and people that have like science facts and things too. I'm just full of information all day from podcasts.
Fantastic. Jenny, thanks so much for sharing that and for listening live today and calling in. Ariel, is this something you've seen? I know there are more hyper-local or state-level podcasts that aren't trying to reach the whole world. Is this a trend? Is this is there room for growth in saying, hey, we've got a local audience we want to reach out to?
I think there's definitely room for growth. And I love that she brought that up, because it really shows the possibilities, right, that are there with podcasts, in that if you're not looking to make a hit, massive 10 million downloads an episode show, you know, there can be a market for that. And look, I live in New York. We don't have, I'm not saying there are no local podcasts. There are definitely some, but a lot of the media here is geared towards more of a national audience. But like, I listen to the Brian Lehrer Show every single day. You know, if I can listen to it on the radio, I do. And if not, then I listen to it as a podcast later. And there's so much value in local shows that talk to issues that actually matter to people, like on a day-to-day basis. And one thing that I've been hearing too is about finding ways to locally target, to basically geo-target ads, right? You come up with ads that are geared towards people based on their location. And that was sort of thought of as a national endeavor, right? It's a way that you can do programmatic ads for a national show, make those ads more relevant to the listener. But there's so much possibility, right, in terms of getting that local advertising and, you know, focusing, being able to get money from businesses in your community that want to be heard by the people in your community, right? Like, I love the idea of local podcasts. There are definitely some. There's not enough yet. But, you know, again, in this period of reconsidering what the industry can look like, I really hope there will be more.
Thanks again for that call. And just our last minute and a half or so, Ariel, want to look toward the future. You've written about so-called AI, artificial intelligence, large language models, and the podcast industry figuring out what to do and not to do with them.
Yeah. That's a doozy of a thing to end with. Well, I will say I was on maternity leave this year and I left in April. And when I left, it was like AI panic. And everyone was freaking out, and I'm back, and it's more like AI acceptance, right? And people are figuring out ways to incorporate AI into shows in a smart way. And this is a story I'm working on right now, actually, is looking at some of those ways that aren't corrosive for the industry overall, right? Like, I don't think any of us want podcasts that are completely AI generated. You know, what's the point? But it does open up some different ways of producing podcasts that can be interesting, like creating voiceovers for social media posts, which is the way that so many people communicate now, for which there's no audio. Anyway, the point is that you'll start seeing it incorporated in lots of ways and in ways that you don't even know about. I mean, hopefully they do a disclosure, but they may not always. So it definitely has the power to transform what we listen to.
Ariel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That's Ariel Shapiro, lead reporter for The Verge's audio industry newsletter, Hot Pod, and a graduate of UW-Madison. She joined us today for a look at the ups and downs of the podcast industry, where it might be headed next. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your favorite podcast now, or maybe one that has come and gone. Let us know about it. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. As a hockey player at UW-Madison, Blake Jeffrion seemed to be destined for big things at the highest levels of the game. He had played for Team USA at many levels of youth hockey. He was drafted by an NHL team partway through college, elected to finish 4 years. After his senior year, he won the Hobie Baker Award as the top college hockey player in the country. Hockey was even in his blood. Pro hockey went back 4 generations, including the legendary Bernie Boom Boom Jeffrion, his grandfather. But just a couple years into his pro career, a horrific on-ice injury ultimately put an end to his playing days. A new book shares Blake's story. The author joins us now along with Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you played competitive hockey yourself? What was your experience like in the sport? If you gave a big part of your life to any sport and your playing days ended, what was it like? How did you handle that transition? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Sam Jeffries is a freelance writer and communications professional and a UW-Madison graduate. He's author of the book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Sam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And legendary UW-Madison hockey star Blake Jeffrion is with us as well. Blake, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. Appreciate it.
Blake, first of all, this book covers some very painful moments in every way of the word in your story. A guy comes up to you and says, I want to write a book about these moments. Did you think twice about wanting to talk about it and relive it?
Yeah, I think my first reaction was, is this guy serious? Out of all the people and all the things in the world you could write a book about, why me? Was actually my knee-jerk and first reaction. But to answer your question more directly, I think everything in this world happens for a reason, good, bad, ugly, or indifferent. And I've taken the good, learned from the bad and kind of moved on. I think that's how I've always been. That's how I was as a player. And, when someone Sam approached me, you know, once I got past it, he was actually real and it wasn't a college buddy messing with me. You know, I was kind of thumbs up and let's do this.
Sam, Blake set up my first question for you. Why Blake? What led you to want to tell his story?
I had gone to Madison and Blake and I overlapped and followed his incredible career, but then followed his pro career after as well, and saw that rise and then the tragedy that ended his playing time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that there was so much additional that I could share and tell, and that he really was the Forrest Gump of hockey, that he had been right place, right time for so many moments in the sport for decades. And so I don't think it was that hard of a sell to convince him that there was even more to his story than maybe he realized.
Now, Blake, your earliest memories of hockey. Now, I mentioned Hockey Dynasty, a Boom Boom Jeffrey on the inventor of the slap shot. There are stories in the book about you riding your tricycle around in circles, pretending it's a Zamboni. What is your first memory of saying, this is what I want to do? I want to play hockey.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three defining moments that stick out, you know, big time for me. You know, number one would be, you know, just getting on the ice and understanding that feeling and pushing around a chair and learning how to skate. You know, two was, you know, the first time that I actually like scored a goal and the sensation and feeling that ran through my body. And that's when I knew I was a true competitor since a very young age. And then I think three was when I was a fairly young kid, and I think this story's in the book, I was shooting pucks in the backyard and my grandfather came out, Boom Boom Jeffrey on, and he goes, that's not how you shoot the puck. You shoot the puck like this there. And he took my little stick, flipped it over because I was lefty, he was a righty, missed the net and put a hole through my fence. And I remember like watching this puck like saucer perfectly and the whole thing. And then my dad instantly came out like, Dad, what are you doing? I just built that fence. And, you know, after I saw my pappy shoot the puck, I was like, oh man, I want to be that guy. I think those are the three defining moments of my early childhood days of you know, wanting to be a hockey player.
And Sam, we just heard that French Canadian accent of Blake's pappy there. But Blake's growing up in the Nashville, Tennessee area. You talk about this in the book. If at that time I was looking, I was a scout, I was going to find my next hockey star, Tennessee, I wasn't going to start there, right?
Probably not. Although hockey had been creeping to Tennessee for a while, and a cool Madison connection, Bob Suter, who was on the Miracle on Ice team and as a Wisconsin native, ended up playing for a minor league team in Nashville back after the Miracle on Ice and before his pro career really took off. So that creep had been going on for a while, but Blake's dad, Danny, and then the entire Jeff Brown family drove so much of that. And it really was an incredible thing for him to get drafted by his hometown team and be able to return to Nashville, you know, 10 plus years removed from his peewee days and you know, wear the colors of the hometown NHL team.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth, and UW hockey star Blake Jeffrion himself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, hockey memories of your own, join in at 800-642-1234. Blake, you have a great teen career going. Some people around the country very curious about where you are going to go to college. What took you to Madison?
Yeah, great question. You know, growing up as a kid, you know, Michigan was always kind of my number one choice, you know, in the South. You know, the only college hockey games we got to see were the Michigan-Michigan State rival games or the national championship game or the Frozen Four. And usually Michigan was always in those games with those cool blue, you know, those blue helmets with the yellow stripes. Always wanted that helmet. And, you know, Red Berenson, who was the coach for a long time there, was a good family friend of ours as well. So I think kind of those two were kind of the number one reasons why I wanted to go there. And really the punchline is, you know, I lived in Ann Arbor for 2 years playing for Team USA and you know, Ann Arbor's great, but I wanted something a little bit more and something, you know, a little bit different. And when I went to Madison and just saw the football game, the small city, although very similar to Ann Arbor around, you know, size, but a little bit bigger, a little bit more of a personality to the town, a little bit more swagger to the town, a great team. And then the ultimate, the Kohl Center, And then Mike Eaves, the head coach there at the time, you know, his assistant, former assistant John Hines, was my head coach at USA. And they had very similar styles of play and the way they looked at the game and, you know, and whatnot. And I think when you combine all of that, when I went to Madison, it was just like, oh, and don't forget the infamous college club owned by the Meyer family, because that was a selling point for me. And I think when you combine all of those, I mean, there was nothing that, you know, you wrap in the great education of Wisconsin. I mean, truthfully, I really don't think there's a better, you know, setup or college hockey program in the country. And I mean that, you know, wholeheartedly, not just because I went there. It's pretty hard to beat Madison.
Sam, UW-Madison had at various points been one of the biggest teams in the country, always at or near the top. What were things like by the time that Blake ends up going to UW-Madison for the hockey program in the late 2000s?
Yeah, so Blake comes in on the heels of the 2006 National Championship, and both men's and women's team won that year, so it was really a crowning achievement for the program in so many ways. And has to inherit a team with high expectations and then have to deal with his own, no offense, but Blake, but big-headedness that doesn't matter what color the helmet was, probably couldn't fit it on. And it ended up being a struggle for the next couple of years, and really the pathway that I think he found himself and then the team under Mike Eaves found its way back to the national championship in 2010 and really put together an incredible run that culminated in so many ways in those Mike Eaves years.
Blake, actually, let's talk about that. Sam writes about this in the book. There were a couple points in your career and a couple big ones in college where you switched your approach to the game and became more of a student of the game, more team focused. Can you talk about what changed your attitude and led to a lot of your success?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think as an 18-year-old kid being drafted as a first round, a first pick, second round of your hometown team, coming off a world championship, entering college where the team that you're going to just won, coming off the national championship and hanging out with those guys and seeing what they're like and whatnot, and then going into freshman year, being like, oh, this is going to be a cakewalk. Like, you know, as Sam alluded to, you know, I was big-headed, arrogant, and the whole thing, as I think any 18-year-old kid would be. You know, and look, I had to learn and grow up and mature. And that while I was a talented guy, it didn't come naturally to me. And the core competency of why I was a good player was my work ethic first and foremost. And if I wasn't working hard, a lot of other things weren't working, if at all. And, you know, I think just like anything in life, you go through, you know, iterations as a player and as a person that, you need to kind of, once the season ended, I always would reflect on what I do well, what I do bad, what I need to improve on, what I need to get back to, what I need to learn from, and whatnot. And I think, you know, freshman year was a very humbling experience for me. And, you know, I got back to my core of, you know, not worrying about the extracurricular activities and, you know, focusing on the game and hockey and just working hard and then evolving from there and just keep getting better and better every year. You know, I think is the core of it.
We're talking to former pro hockey player and Badger star Blake Jeffrion, also with us Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up, we'll talk about the injury that ended Blake's career just a few years into his pro stint, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been a fan recently or for a long time of the UW hockey program? Did you yourself pour a lot of time and energy into playing a certain sport when those days ended? What did it mean to you? Join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Blake Jeffrion, former Wisconsin Badger hockey star, professional hockey player, and Sam Jeffries, author of the new book Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrion and the Fastest Game on Earth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions for our guests, Blake, I want to take you now a couple years into your pro career. You've played with that hometown team in Nashville, traded to the Montreal Canadiens. It's the strike season. You're playing with the minor league team. What might look like a routine moment in hockey changed your life. if you're willing to, can you share your experience of that moment and what you remember of it and what came after?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, I remember it was we were playing a game in the Bell Center. It was during the lockout, so we wanted to give something to the fans. I was playing for the Montreal Canadiens minor league team. My mom and dad flew up. They were actually in Boston watching my brothers play, and then drove up to Montreal to watch me. It was a couple shifts into the first period, and you know, puck turned over inside the blue line of our own end. I turned it up, and you know, was going down the boards, tried to jump out of the way of a hip check. And long and short is, you know, his skate went one way, my shoulder went the other, or head went the other. Kind of skate came up and hit me right in the side of the head. You know, I had suffered a lot of concussions in my career, both, you know, very, very minor to all of being knocked out and unconscious. So, I had known what a concussion felt like, and I'd known if I'd had one. And after that collision happened, which was a hard collision, I definitely thought I did. But when I, you know, as a, when that happens to me, usually my peripheral vision goes. So it looks like you're, you know, it seems as if you're looking down, like, look, you have two straws you're looking down. It's kind of the best way to describe it. And I didn't have that. So I was sitting on my knees and, you know, kind of waiting for a second. And then, you know, of course, a fight breaks out, or, you know, a scrum breaks out. And then, you know, I kind of stood up, I sat back, put my head up, and I just felt like a warm sensation go down my back, which was a bunch of blood. And then I was like, oh man, I gotta get off the ice. So I skated off the ice with my head kind of over, you know, and I get to the trainer's room. Or, I'm sorry, get to the bench where my trainers met with a towel. You know, he puts it up. I go into the trainer's room. They don't know where I'm kind of bleeding from. And long story short is I had a pretty severe cut in the side of my head, and they looked at it and kind of disappeared very quickly. Mind you, these guys all are speaking in French, so I don't know what they're saying whatsoever. And they come flying back 100 miles an hour with the doctor. The doctor says, you know, something very quickly in French. And everything started moving very quickly from there on out. You know, next thing I know, my mom and dad are down there. I'm in a stretcher, and I'm off to the hospital. You know, the last memory I had before I went unconscious was, you know, I went into the hospital in a stretcher, looking up into those, you know, one of those rooms that's really cold. And, you know, I passed out. And the punchline there is I had a depressed cold fracture and internal bleeding on my brain, which caused me to kind of, you know, go unconscious. Mm-hmm. So that was the last thing I remember until I woke up. You know, I don't remember how many hours, but a lot of hours later. So.
And Sam, I'm not an athlete. I'm a parent of athletes, not at Blake's level. My first thought was his parents are there, right? And when you see your kid down, you don't know what's happened. You talk to Blake's family members about their experience. Could you talk about how they talked about that moment?
Yeah, and it was really one of the amazing things for the Jeffrion family to be so open with me. His mom, Kelly, who's a tremendous storyteller, walked me through being in the stands and I think being a little casual when it first happened, because they have Blake is not their only son. They all play hockey.
They've seen injuries their share before. Of injuries.
Yeah. That's right. They've seen injuries. They've seen concussions. And I remember her telling me, oh, first thought was, oh, another concussion, and kind of, you know, girding themselves for that recovery. And it wasn't until being in the hospital and having to rush Blake to surgery that they really understood that this time was different and the seriousness of it, speaking French or not, that really came through very quickly. And so she was open and transparent, and then had to unfortunately be the one to make the call to Blake's fiance at the time, and his now wife, Kaylin. And Kaylin was taking a night off from law school, having a well-deserved break with friends, and gets the call, not having in her mind Blake's playing schedule, not knowing where and when the game was that night. And, you know, immediately fell to her knees and broke down and really described being near catatonic, traveling from Chicago to Montreal to be with him bedside. So it was, you know, and everyone I talked to, there was a real delayed reaction. I think nobody understood the danger or the risks. And then I spoke to the surgeon and the trainer, and I think for the medical side, they all understood very quickly how bad this was, how close he was to do something far more severe than what happened, and how lucky it was that there was no NHL that night, because they actually had the best in the business sitting there ringside ready to help.
Talking to Sam Jeffries, author of the new book, Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrey on and the Fastest Game on Earth, and Blake Jeffrey on himself, former pro and UW-Madison hockey player. Blake, there's a moment in the book after this injury, the recovery, it takes time, it's difficult, and you're evaluating hockey, and the thought might be, oh, do you make a comeback, do you not? And it seems like you're asking yourself, even before the injury, was it worth it? Is this where I want to be? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, look, I think, I had suffered 13 documented concussions in my career. We all know the short-term and long-term effects of concussions, or what's out there. And, I had spoken to a lot of people, both former players, current players, neurologists. I mean, anyone and everyone, you pretty much name it, I had spoken to. And what the common theme that kept coming back was, Blake, it's actually, it's scientifically proven that it's not actually as a big of a deal if you suffer a lot of concussions. It's around two core competencies, and that is, number one, does the time period that you're out continue to get longer and longer? Is the first and foremost question you have to ask yourself. And then secondly, how often are they occurring, inside that? And I would say, historically, when I had suffered a concussion, I was usually back within, a couple of days to a week, feeling pretty much ready to go. And I would say my last two concussions that I had suffered previously were fairly within reach of each other. And both of those were, I was out longer term, and they were, each of those consecutively were longer durations of being out. And then when you suffer something like this, it's actually, substantially worse than a concussion, obviously. And, it's actually, a bruise to your brain. Everyone was just like, look, dude, you can go, first of all, if you can find a doctor to let you play and is willing to assume liability, by all means, best of luck to you on that one. But secondly, there's no way that you should come back and play. You should move on, live a long and happy life, and not have, long-term effects associated with this, and go do something else. And, so it was kind of writing on the wall, and that's how I'd always kind of made every decision, was kind of, if you talk to enough people, usually you get a gut feeling around it, the right decision to make, or it kind of slaps you in the face on what you should do in life. Turning to the ones you're closest with and people that know the most about that industry. And I think after I did that, it was kind of, the writing was on the wall. It was time for me to step away and go do something else.
You did continue to work in hockey. You did some time as a scout and into management. You still love the game?
I still do love the game. As you said, I went on to be a scout, and as I like to call it, a road warrior, and then into management. But ultimately, still love the game, still watch it. I just made a bet with my dad over the weekend that I still think Connor McDavid will lead the NHL in scoring this year. It's nice that he's got 11 points in his last three games. I still love the game, still follow pretty closely, have a lot of friends that still play. Going through all this, I think the one thing that I've found is that family and friends are most important to me. And I was no longer willing to sacrifice those relationships in exchange for the game of hockey. So moved on to do something else.
I will leave it there. Blake, thanks for joining us today.
Anytime, guys. Thanks for having me. And Sam, as always, pal, good to see you. And thanks for writing the book, pal.
Yeah, and Sam, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm grateful for the time and excited to hear what people think. It was a special journey to be able to write it and something else to have it out in the world and for Blake's kids and my own to be able to read it one day.
We've been talking to former pro hockey player and UW-Madison star Blake Jeffrey and author Sam Jeffries. Sam's new book is called Legacy on Ice, Blake Jeffrey and the Fastest Game on Earth. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent as winter weather settles in around Wisconsin. Get a lot of perspectives on the latest efforts to solve the problem of homelessness in the state. Governor Evers will join the show, as well as lawmakers from both parties. And you could join in with what you're seeing when it comes to homelessness in your own community, maybe in your own life. You can start the conversation right now with an email at ideas@wpr.org. Then join Kate and her guests. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever watched Sesame Street with your kids or as a kid, you've probably seen Cookie Monster with a cookie. Eating the cookie, air quotes around eating, since he can't actually swallow them, and crumbs just fly over all over the place. You might have wondered, are those real cookies? The answer is sort of, but you wouldn't want to eat them. The New York Times tackled the question. Apparently, multiple people have asked over the years. Somebody actually bakes cookies for Cookie Monster. They used rice cakes for a while. That didn't work so good. The recipe includes things like pancake mix, puffed rice, grape nuts, and instant coffee. Okay, weird cookies, but you can eat that stuff. But wait. The chocolate chips are made with hot glue sticks, so they're not chocolate, they're just colored bits of glue. Oh yeah, along with no chocolate, there's no oil, no fat, no sugar. All those things could stain Cookie Monster. The key is not to make a delicious cookie, it's to make something that's easy to clean up after and blows up easily into lots of crumbs. When it comes down to it, C is for cookie. That good enough for me. This is Central Time.